Good afternoon. So, last time, Skadron covered lecture, which I understand had some exciting prelude, that I had the wonder of coordinating from far away and not knowing what was happening, where we went over deadlock. So, deadlock is this problem where we have multiple threads, typically multiple threads. There's a trivial deadlock with one thread waiting for itself, but typically we're thinking about multiple threads where basically one thread's waiting for another thread, and that other thread is waiting for the first thread. And unless someone stops waiting at some point, we're just gonna hang. And this is a reason if you write programs with locks and aren't paying attention, your programs could hang. And something which makes this really pernicious is that essentially always this hang is inconsistent. It's the result of something that's a race condition, so that's really dependent on timing. So you can't just test your program and reliably find cases where you have this hanging. It's going to be the kind of bug where if you're like working at a company, some customer will tell you your software hangs after 3 hours, and good luck reproducing that. So we talked about sort of a more systematic way of looking at deadlock. And we started with saying, well, what causes deadlock? And we had these kind of key requirements. The kind of biggest ones were this idea of hold and wait. In order to have deadlock, we need to be holding a resource kind of exclusively so someone else can't use it while waiting for something else. If we don't do this, then we won't have a deadlock. So the most common example of doing this is that we acquire a lock, kind of saying that we should be the only ones accessing something, and then we wait for another lock. So if we, for example, only have one lock in total, there's no way to have a deadlock because we'll never be holding one lock and acquiring another. And in addition to hold and wait, we need some sort of circular dependency to arise. And by looking at our definition, we could say, what are some things we can do to avoid deadlock? And our lab tomorrow is going to be about sort of implementing those in the toy dining philosopher's problem. And kind of, I think the two most practical ways are a lock order and kind of undo and retry. So by lock order, I mean, well, if we always acquire locks in the same order, we can't have a circular dependency. And this maybe isn't like immediately obvious, but one way of thinking of the intuition is that if we have an order for our locks or other resources we're acquiring, we can kind of say that we're gonna, you know, if we lay out our things like visually, we're gonna acquire always from left to right, which means our dependencies will go from left to right. But in order to have a circular dependency, we need to have one thing going backwards. And if we never go right to left, always left to right, that's not possible. We'll never have that circle. And lock order, I think if you're writing typical programs that use threads, is almost always what you're going to want to try to do to avoid deadlock. If you can't do that, or it's too inefficient to do that, the most other common strategy is this undo and retry strategy, where we detect we can't get a lock right away, or somehow detect we're in a deadlock situation. There's various levels of sophistication, but something happens and we say, well, you know, probably I shouldn't really be waiting for this. So instead of waiting for something, we don't wait for it, we unrelease the resources we have or get someone else to release those resources and retry the operation later. And I think these two are definitely the two most common sort of real-world deadlock solutions. So if you're writing code and you're seeing typical Reddit code, as I said, lock order is almost certainly what you're going to use. It's very common for databases to use that second sort of undo and retry strategy internally, because databases, if you're thinking of, you know, making a database that handles whatever things you want to store in it and whatever queries you want to do, it's really hard to do the lock order solution, so they'll often do the undo and retry solution. Questions about things we covered last time? Yeah?
So the last lecture, the professor talked about like a trick where like if you do the locks and the floss, that is a bit of a deadlock. Is that like the most efficient way to kind of understand it? Like, it's a deadlock, like the fastest way to understand a deadlock?
If I draw the locks and they cross, that's not a trick I've used personally, but that's equivalent to like you're finding the circular dependency, right? That's one way of doing that. Personally, I would typically like draw out the graph, like the ones we saw in the lecture slides, to do it. Does that answer your question? But I guess I would say, related to that, like because lock order is a solution to deadlock, something you can do is you can look for the lock order not being consistent. And that's, like, that isn't by itself sufficient for deadlock, but most of the time when you see that the lock order being inconsistent, there's a problem. And that's probably the most practical thing to do in real code, is to say, even if we don't need it every single place, we're going to have a single lock order, and we're going to assume code that doesn't use a single lock order is broken. Even though maybe technically there's a reason why you can prove there's no circular dependency, even if the lock order is not consistent. That answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so I'll talk briefly about anonymous feedback. Summary of this is someone liked Professor Skadron's lecture and thought, in contrast, I felt my lectures are rushed. That's probably true. That's a tendency I have had for public speaking since high school. That Professor Skadron went into a lot of detail about sort of examples in code, and I tend not to do that, and implying that I gloss over things. So if I'm glossing over things, I probably don't know. Please let me know specifics. I probably am rushing. One thing is that often I'm probably more worried than I should be about, am I going to get through everything I need to get through in the semester? Which I probably shouldn't, because there's other things I can do about that, but that's a way I think. They also mentioned that Skadron had less what they call unnecessary and irrelevant questions. I'm not sure how to optimize for that. I like getting questions because they give me some clue about where I am in the lecture as far as people understanding things. But yes, not all questions are worth the time. I like getting questions, so maybe I'm on the wrong side of that balance. I guess I'd say on the issue of like showing code and like explaining it in detail, and sometimes I don't do that, and sometimes that's a deliberate decision, and maybe that's the wrong one. So when I'm showing an exercise, I usually very deliberately don't explain most of the code in the exercise on the assumption that you should have more time to go over it yourselves to do it, the exercise. Maybe that's the wrong choice. I can see the arguments for both sides. I'm not sure. I guess probably I should lean a little more towards explaining some things when I show up an exercise with code. But I've usually leaned very heavily towards not explaining it on the assumption that you should have more time to work on it yourself, but that could very well be not the right choice. And also feedback saying the quiz was very hard, and particularly questions 2 through 4. So as I'll discuss, I'm gonna go over some things on the quiz. As I'll discuss for questions 3 and 4, I should have excluded certain types of answers and made the questions unintentionally tricky by not doing so. But I think I should go over, I'll go over a few things on the quiz since a lot of things were missed. So in question 1, we had some code where the idea was doing a binary search, and to make this multi-threaded, we would have a lock for each node of the tree, and the idea was that we would lock, since we locked each node separately, if we had two search operations that were using different nodes, they could run in parallel. They were using the same node, we'd have an exclusive lock, so if something else was, say, changing a node, we wouldn't have to worry. That was kind of how the code was written. And the first question asked, what changes would make it so we have sort of more use of multiple cores? And what you should think about is what stops us from using multiple cores in that code is if we're waiting for a lock. So where do we have we're taking turns, and the only yes answer is where we have sort of spread out the nodes among the sort of two halves of the tree more evenly, because that means that they're less likely to be waiting for each other for locks. The other scenario is kind of increased how often they'd be going down the same set of nodes, and therefore increase the likelihood they'd be waiting for the same lock. So questions about quiz question one? And on quiz question two, probably A is the one I should go over based on what I remember from looking at quiz. So quiz question two showed you some code that tried to manipulate the tree, the search tree, by removing some nodes. And there was one bug, which was a problem here, which is that with the way that these find code works, the find code could retrieve a pointer, and that pointer could be deleted before it actually recurses into the tree and tries to access it, therefore causing it to access a free pointer. So this didn't actually really work. Question A, which a lot of people got wrong, asked about, well, could we have a case where, because the code is modifying a node's value and its left child, where the find routine looks at a different value in left child and therefore goes to the wrong node? It has a problem from that. And the answer was, well, when the code modified value in left child, it did it with a lock. And when find read value in the left child, it did that with a lock. So they take turns doing that whole set of things. So there's nowhere the find routine could read an old value and a new left child, or vice versa. It would either run entirely before the changes or entirely after the changes. So questions on how that worked for quiz question two, option A. Okay, so then talking about quiz question three. So my intention with quiz question three is that we had these two functions. We had a barrier that asked for two threads at a time, and we had these two functions that both used global. And to avoid race conditions, we want to make sure they take turns using global. And the intention was, well, the only way we have to synchronize them is this barrier, so we're going to use the barrier to do that. And if you leave all the barrier wait calls as is, then what you'll see is that in function two, when I is 1, 3, 5, and so on, then we know the global is not being accessed. It's therefore F2's turn to modify global. When it's 0, 2, 4, 6, it could be being accessed. Therefore, it's not F2's turn to access global. And so my intended solution for what condition do we use for when we actually add stuff to global in F2 is only when I is I. So a bunch of people realized that I didn't specify you couldn't do some other things in the if statement that I usually don't think of doing in if statements. And the two of them were, in decreasing order of commonness, calling pthread barrier wait, which, yep, that works, and resolves this problem in a different way. Or, less commonly, modifying N and M. Which can work. You have to make sure you're modifying N when it's not being read by the F1, but that's actually possible to do. I didn't see a correct solution when I checked this morning that handled that part of the problem. And for grading, we'll look for, did you solve the race condition issue and run the ifs without like just putting if false? Is like what we're gonna look for, basically. A little nit on this. So since I didn't expect you to use barrier in an if statement, I didn't actually talk about what pthread barrier wait returns. And since we're going to use it in an upcoming assignment, probably should talk about that. So pthread barrier wait. Barrier wait. So if we have x equals pthread barrier rate, We have x equals 0 is success, sort of. And we also have x equals the special constant p thread barrier serial thread, which is also success, and x equals something else is an error. So pthread barrier weight has this feature, which I have never found useful, but exists, where it will choose one thread that waited on the barrier and have it return a different value to tell you, to let you do something special in one thread, you know, chosen arbitrarily. I haven't never found this useful myself, but it's a feature that's there. And this means that a lot of you wrote code which like did pthread barrier weight equals equals 0 that technically doesn't work. We're not going to take off, we're going to give credit for it, but it technically does not work because of that. Some questions on question 3. So quiz question 4 was asking to set the number of loop iterations and to make the code terminate. And the key observation here is that if we have a barrier that expects 2 threads and only 1 thread waits on it, that other thread's going to be waiting forever. The thread that waits on it is going to wait forever because there's never going to be another thread joining it. So you need to make the number of barrier calls last. This would be twice as many loop iterations if you don't add a barrier wait. Questions? Okay, and then we had quiz question 5, had various sort of questions about race conditions. And usually what I do to solve these sorts of things is I write down, I would look at the order of locks, and the first thing I'm going to look for is, do we have an inconsistent lock order? Because if we have a consistent lock order between the two functions, we know there's no deadlock. And if we have an inconsistent one, then I try to prove there's some ordering I can get to make the deadlock happen. So that's how I try to solve these problems. So with quiz 5A, we can say, well, these both lock A before locking anything else, that's going to be okay. And they all have a consistent order. For quiz 5B, we all have overlap in A, but since they're all doing their work when locking A, they should take turns like actually doing things with B and C. So we shouldn't have a circular dependency with B and C and so on. I believe I dropped 5C because 5C was trickier than I wanted it to be. Deadlock can occur because the first move can change where A1 is if it runs fast enough, and then we have a deadlock, which is because we're doing kind of the classical deadlock of question 6. I dropped it because I don't think seeing the move changes where which page it is not something I wanted to be tested, really. And I think the others, and 5E was the only other one people didn't have trouble with, So if we assume the move doesn't happen first, I write down the locks, you can see we have this kind of contradictory lock order, which can create a problem. Yeah. Is that the, let me check if I wrote buggy quiz code. Yes, okay, I can't write code. So I will edit the quiz to drop a few more questions for that. because you are correct. Yes, it pulls the lock open, which is clearly a bug. It should, there should be the break, there should be an, the break should be after the unlock in some way. Like, I guess the way I would probably do that, thinking about it, is I'd add a Boolean variable and have a break after the, if that variable unlock, break after the unlock in the loop. Yes? I am going to, I will look through, you can make a re-request. I'm going to look through, see which things are affected by that, and just mark them as credit for any answer, if the answer would be correct when it wasn't before. Because you are, that is correct. I'm sorry, I missed that, and the person who looked over, people who looked over this missed that. But that is, yeah, that's a real problem, and that's a, you can call that a deadlock. I'm not sure whether you call that a deadlock or not is complicated, but yeah, you can call that a deadlock. Okay, other questions? Yeah.
So, like, I was wondering if that would be a deadlock or not, since deadlock is technically like two things waiting for each other, but in this case, it's only one thing waiting, and the other thing's already exited, so that's not a deadlock.
Whether it be deadlock or not. So, if we look at our definition, well, I guess if we consider a thread that's running that holds a lock and hasn't unlocked it as holding the lock, then as long as the thread that called that function is still running, it meets our definition of deadlock. But yes, the real bug, of course, is that we are never unlocking it. And probably we're never unlocking it even if the thread does exit. And that is, you could argue that that's a different bug. But I think it meets the definition of deadlock, at least arguably, even if the thread exits. Yes, so I will correct the quiz. Yes, so I just made a, yeah, I just forgot to check that I wasn't skipping over unlocks, which is a real thing, that problem that with writing threaded code, and a reason I don't really like writing threaded code in C. Because other languages have ways of making that less likely. Okay, so, and, right. And question six, we fixed the problem with consistent block order. So, other questions about the quiz? Okay, so, we've talked a bunch about locks and deadlock and problems like that. We're going to talk about sort of solving things that don't fit into the patterns of locks or barriers, which are the two synchronization constructs we've talked about. And there's a big problem pattern I'm going to focus on to start with, which could have its own special solution. We're going to give a more, use a generic tool to solve this problem. But we're going to use this as sort of a way of illustrating how that generic tool works. And you can use that generic tool to solve other problems. But this problem is actually really common. It's all the time when we're writing code that needs to synchronize multiple threads, it falls into this producer-consumer pattern. And in this pattern, we have one or more producer threads that are adding stuff to a buffer that one or more consumer threads are taking things out of. And they don't work in lockstep, so there's times when they need to wait for each other. So if our buffer has some limited size, we want the producer threads to wait when the buffer will be full, rather than just running out, having us run out of memory. When the buffer is empty, we want the consumer threads to wait for something to be put onto the buffer, rather than just like giving up. And as an example of kind of a non-obvious situation where this happens, a C compiler is often could be structured in this way. That a C, if you think of writing C, we have a preprocessor that like runs before we do the real compilation. When we compile, we make assembly and we want to feed that to a linker. Like it has this, fits this kind of pattern. And this is a way we can kind of eke out sort of doing some things in parallel in that process. So we're going to talk about one tool for that can handle the producer-consumer case in actually practically any sort of way you might want to coordinate multiple threads. And this is something called monitors. And a monitor is going to consist of a lock and some number of conditioned variables. So a lock we've already learned about, the degree of mutual exclusion, we take terms. And conditioned variables are going to be a tool for waiting for an event. Now, I think conditioned variables are the most poorly named thing in this class, and we talked about translation look-aside buffers already, so that's saying something. So a conditioned variable, as the name does not suggest, represents a list of threads that are waiting. It has three operations. One is to start waiting, adding yourself to the list, and the others are to do something about the threads that are waiting. There's a signal and a broadcast operation which wake up different numbers of waiting threads and let them start running again. And when we're talking about monitors, we'll pair this lock and these list of waiting threads with some data that we're managing. So in the case of our producer-consumer example, it's going to be that buffer and sort of the metadata, like how much stuff is in the buffer and so on. So in pthreads, we're going to see that we're going to be kind of building this ourselves. So I'm saying a monitor is the combination of all these things. You know, that's what I'm saying here. In pthreads, you know, we don't like declare a monitor, we declare a lock, a few conditioned variables, some data that we access with them. In a language like Java, and something that gives you probably more of an idea where this idea of monitors came from, objects are monitors. So Java objects, in fact, all have a built-in lock and a built-in condition variable. So every Java object you can use as a monitor. It has this functionality. And the shared data would be all the fields of your object. But in pthreads, we're going to be building our own. It's not going to happen for us. So here's my sort of conceptual picture of a monitor. We have our lock, our shared data, our condition variables, that is our list of waiting threads, and some associated operations. So for producer, consumer, these are going to be adding to the buffer or removing things from the buffer. And we're going to have a rule that we're going to have this one lock. We're going to acquire that lock before we ever access any of these things. And if we think conceptually about locks, we can have threads waiting on a lock. So a lock kind of has, you know, is a way of accessing a list of threads that are waiting. So there's a bunch of threads waiting for the lock. So we think when this system is running, we have a bunch of threads that are ready to use the shared data, but are waiting to take their turn. And I told you that our condition variables are also a list of threads. And these threads are waiting for something to happen with the shared data. So they can't run right away, but they're waiting for something to let them run. And the reason it's called a condition variable, like at least one part of the name makes sense, is the condition part. They're waiting for some particular condition to be true. So if we have multiple condition variables, the reason we have separate ones is different threads that are waiting for things are waiting for different things to happen. And we'll see some examples of that later. So let's talk about our operations on these condition variables and how they sort of work in this picture. So we have a wait operation, and we're going to call that with a condition variable and a lock. I'll talk about what the lock's doing later, but the condition variable, you know, we said it represents a list of waiting threads. This adds the current thread to the list, and that thread starts waiting for one of the other operations to be called. So it takes this lock, and A problem with starting waiting is, let's say we're waiting for something. Let's say we say, let's start waiting. And just before we start waiting, the thing we're waiting for happens. If we aren't careful about that, what could happen is that, like, let's say we wait for something to be in the buffer. So what we do is we say, let's look at the buffer, find out there's nothing in there, and start waiting. And if we don't do anything extra there, in between when we find out the buffer's empty and we start waiting, someone could add something to the buffer and we'll never find out. They won't wake us up because we weren't waiting. So to avoid that, we're going to always check the thing we're waiting for while holding the lock, and we're not going to release the lock ourselves. We're going to have the wait function do that. And the wait function is going to know how to start waiting and release the lock at the same time. And because when we get back from waiting, we're going to want to manipulate the shared data, it's going to automatically acquire the lock again before it returns. But it's going to unlock the lock because, well, we need to be unlocked while we're waiting, or else we'll create lots of deadlocks. Yes? Which is the current thread in the diagram? That would be the one in the, for this case, that is being added to the list of waiting threads.
So it gets added from the list in the middle to the top list?
So it gets, in this case, we're calling it on a condition variable. So if we're calling on a condition variable one, the thread will be added to presumably the end of the list of waiting threads. I'm showing it at the end. There's actually no guaranteed ordering with the system we're using, though it might make sense to have in some, if you were like cared about performance in some way. So we see it being added here, and later on something's going to happen. Now, I guess I haven't shown all of where it is, because we didn't talk about it unlocking the lock, right, and things like that. So let's talk about the other part of this. So I'm showing the add current thread. We also have this unlock lock. So unlocking the lock, a way we can think about what that does is that takes the thread that was waiting for the lock and lets it go. So that's not the current thread. Our current thread is here, but when we call pthreadconwait, it's going to let someone who is waiting for the lock start going while we're waiting. If no one's waiting for the lock, well, we just wait until something else happens. And sometime later, we're going to stop waiting and we're going to get that lock again, but that hasn't happened yet, because in order for us to stop waiting, we need to have one of the layer two functions we call, which we'll talk about next. But first, questions on wait itself. Yeah?
So I think it was for access to campaign, instead of monitor, you need to have a log. When you say access, does that include just reading the data or using it as a reference? Is it a write to it?
Question. When I say we're going to have this convention that we acquire the lock before accessing the data in the monitor, does that include just reading? Yes. In the most relevant way, it's very important that we have the lock before reading something that's going to cause us to wait. Because if we don't do that, we can have the problem that we read something, we decide to wait based on it, and in between the time we read it and we decide to wait, it changes.
This is different from usual locks, kind of, right?
This is different from usual locks? I would not say so. Like, the only thing that's different is that we have this special wait function that works with the lock. Otherwise, the lock acts the same way as our normal locks. And that serves to make us take turns doing anything with the data. Other questions? Okay, so we have threads that are waiting for something, and we need to tell them when to stop waiting, And what's going to happen is some other thread is going to call either broadcast or signal. We'll start with broadcast. So the broadcast function, we call it on our condition variable, our list of waiting threads. That says now all those waiting threads should get to run. And since the first thing those threads are going to do is acquire the lock again, you can think of conceptually this takes the list of waiting threads, adds them to the list of people waiting for the lock. We also have a signal operation which chooses one of the threads that's waiting. In the API we'll be using, it chooses arbitrarily, who knows how, and lets it start running. So it's going to wait for the lock and run as soon as the lock is available. Do it. Some questions? This interface. Okay. So let's do a very simple example. As far as these things, well, these might be not very simple, but simpler than some of the future examples we use of using a condition variable. So here I have a condition variable finish CV, and I have a lock, and I have some shared data. Our shared data is this one Boolean which is finished. So if finish is true, we finish something. If finish is not true, we haven't. And I have two functions that manipulate this shared data. One, this finish function, marks this as having finished. And the other, wait for finished, waits for finish to be true. And the way wait for finish works, I'll start with that, is that it checks if finished is already true. And if it's not already true, it waits. It adds itself to the list of waiting threads. And in order to have this work, we need to have the code that sets finish to true know about this list of waiting threads. It's not going to happen for free. And that code does know. It knows too that it needs to let all those threads run after it sets finish to true. And notice that we're always doing this pattern of always acquiring the lock before accessing our shared data. And some of you might notice, wait, there's this while loop? Couldn't that be an if statement? We'll discuss this later. The answer is no. And indeed, it's not obvious that it can't be an if statement, but it turns out the answer is no. So we wait. And notice that while we're waiting, we're releasing the lock because we passed that to pthread. Wait, that's really important because if we didn't do that, then this finish function couldn't run. It would just be paused on its first line. It wouldn't be able to do anything. And our broadcast here lets everyone who's waiting, so this supports multiple threads calling wait for finish. It lets all of them run. They have to acquire the lock after we release it first, of course, but we'll all get to run. So there's kind of two ways that this could happen. So one way is that we call wait for finish first, and wait for finished gets the lock. Maybe finished, if it runs right now, it has to wait for finished to finish doing its little bit of work. And wait for finish little bit of work is checking the finish flag, finding out we aren't finished yet, and starting waiting, which releases the lock. After it releases the lock, the finish thread can set finish to true and broadcast, and that will move our wait for finish thread to the list of threads waiting for the lock. When finish releases the lock, those wait for finish threads will run again. They'll go back to the top of their while loop, they'll find out, oh, now finished is in fact true. Let's return, unlock and return. Another way this could happen is that we could call finish first. So in that case, it's going to set finish to true. It's going to wake up all zero waiting threads, which does nothing. And it's going to unlock. And wait for finish runs later. It checks that finished is true. Doesn't need to wait. It says we're done. You know, the while loop runs no iterations, and it just unlocks and returns. So questions about our wait for finished example? Okay. So I promised I would talk about why we have this loop. Because it seems like this should be unnecessary. We should just be able to put an if statement here because, well, if we start waiting and we stop waiting, someone must have called broadcast. There's only one call to broadcast. It's after we set finish to true. Surely we don't need to double check that finish is true. And there's an unfortunate detail about this wait function I didn't tell you. If we look in the man page for pthread cond wait, which is pthread's version of that wait function, it says, this has this line that spurious wakeups may occur. What is a spurious wakeup? That means that pthread cond wait decides to stop waiting just on its own. It's allowed to do that. So you might say, why did they do this? My understanding is that basically waking up in some corner cases makes it a lot easier to implement pthread cond wait and cond broadcast and cond signal. So they've decided that there's some rare but not impossible corner cases where cond wait will return early. And they decided that they're just going to let it do that. And as we'll see later, it's actually very hard not to double check the condition. So in this simple example, as far as what we're waiting for is very simple, it's pretty easy to reason about that we shouldn't need to double check. But we'll see when we go to implementing producer or consumer with this, that it's actually very hard to have correct code that doesn't double check the condition anyways. So the decision they made is that you're always going to write code that checks the thing you were waiting for after you stop waiting anyways. And if you do that, it's okay if rarely, but sometimes wait returns early. But that means that you need to write a while loop to use cond wait. You can't just use an if statement. So questions on this spurious wake up issue? So now that we know somewhat how cond wait works, let's start implementing our producer-consumer pattern. And I'm going to do an unbounded buffer producer-consumer, which means that we're going to have producers that add to this buffer and consumers that remove things from it. But we're going to have this case where the buffer is empty and consumers are trying to remove things from it, and we need to have them wait. So I have my lock that we always have for monitors. I have my shared data, which is my queue, my buffer of things that are waiting to be consumed. And I have a condition variable that represents the list of threads that are waiting for data. And we can see that in our consume function, we use that condition variable to wait until the buffer is not empty. So while the buffer is empty, we're going to keep waiting. When the buffer is not empty, we stop waiting. And because we stop waiting, we can actually get something out of the buffer and then return it. And we can see our produce function. After it enqueues something, it knows that, well, this might have let someone stop waiting, so it uses signal to let one thread pick up that item if it was waiting for it. Yes?
Can you repeat what data ready was?
Data ready is a condition variable, meaning a list of waiting threads, and the threads in this case are all waiting for something to be in the buffer.
Okay.
So I've as will be the convention I often use, I name the condition variable after what they're waiting for. Questions? code. Okay, so something to note about how we've constructed this code is that because of how our while loop works, we are checking if the buffer is empty, and then immediately, when it's not empty, dequeuing. This means we never have to worry about calling dequeue with the buffer being empty. That is not possible with this code, because we have the lock. Therefore, no one else is adding things to the buffer, because we have this convention. We only do that with the lock. Reduce function only does that with the lock. So we know that in between when we check buffer empty and dequeue, no one else is touching the buffer, assuming we follow the convention that we always use the lock. I would say also, I would point out that this is one reason why it's important that Conway reacquires the lock before returning. And I'd like to mention this con signal here. It wakes up a thread. If no threads are waiting, does nothing, that's fine. What will happen in that case? Well, sometime later, a thread will ask for something. It will find out there's something. It will go to consume. We'll check if there's something on the buffer, find out there is, not wait at all, just dequeue and return. So let's talk about this loop here and how many times it runs. So I mentioned the case where it runs no times, that we can have produce be called, we lock, add something to this buffer, signal no one, and dequeue, and then consume gets called, it locks, it checks if the buffer is empty, find out it isn't because produce ran earlier, dequeues, unlocks, and returns, and does no wait. So that's how this loop can run zero times. And it's also fairly straightforward to think about how this loop can run one time. We consume when there's nothing there yet. We lock, we find out it's empty, we start waiting, which automatically unlocks because of how pthread-cond wait works. Produce gets to run sometime later. It locks, enqueues, signals, stops us from waiting, but we need to get the lock. So we aren't on the list of threads waiting for something to be in the buffer, but we're on the list of threads waiting to get access to the shared data. We get access, find out it's not empty anymore, dequeue, unlock, and return. Now, so we have the loop running zero times and one time. It turns out it can also run two or more times, and I don't need spurious wakeups to do that. So I told you spurious wakeups are a way that can happen, right? That if wait just returns randomly, well, we'll run the loop more times. So if wait just returns here when we haven't produced yet, yeah, we're going to go through the loop and try again. But it turns out it can happen even if wait works perfectly. And to illustrate this, we're going to need a third thread. So our third thread here is going to run at a very inconvenient time. It starts running, in this case, while the produce is running. And let's say we have a policy that the way our locks work, the first thread that tries to get the lock is the one that gets it first. So in this case, our consume thread asks for the lock before thread 2 stopped waiting. So it gets it first. It finds out that the queue isn't empty, dequeues and unlocks. And that means that when thread 2 gets to run afterwards, because it was signaled to run, it finds out it's empty because thread 3 just got rid of something. And it's going to go back to waiting. Some questions on how this scenario works? Yes?
So depending on the runtime of producer and consumer, there is an optimal ratio of threads to produce and to consume.
Question, depending on the runtime of producer and consumer, there's an optimal ratio of threads. So I would say, performance-wise, our best case is like if we can have this work where we never wait. Right. So if you're thinking of how do I make this as efficient as possible, well, the most efficient version of this is that we basically almost never wait, and the waits are just for rare cases. I don't know if that answers your question. Under what condition would it almost never wait? If we always have, if our producers and consumers are roughly the same speed, and the producers have a little head start, that's kind of the ideal scenario. But in practice, of course, we can't get that sort of exact right timing, so someone's going to wait at some point. And hopefully not most of the time, but sometimes most of the time. Other questions about how we got this sort of this third thread sneaking in at an inconvenient time? So an observation you might have about this scenario is that, you know, logically speaking, you know, this thread was signaled, and the problem we had here is that even though this thread was woken up, it didn't get to run next. That the produce function chose this thread, but the thread that actually ran next is some other random thread that just happened to squeeze in at a certain time. And something we could do is we could say, well, signal really should guarantee that the thread gets to run next. We chose a thread to run, let's run that thread next. And there have been systems that implement this. Pthreads is not one of them. But there's this alternate design called core scheduling, named after the inventor of it, where the signal function kind of hands off to the waiting thread. This is not done by any threading library I am aware of in common use today. So you are not going to get the luxury of this. You will have to deal with the case that, sorry, this signal, just because you got woken up doesn't mean you get to run right away, which means that by the time your signal gets you run, it might be the case the thing you were waiting for is no longer available. So that's what happens here, is that we were waiting for the buffer not to be empty. Well, it wasn't empty, but by the time we figured that out, it was too late. It was empty again. So the type of monitors we usually use are these MESA-style monitors, named after the first system that implemented them. And in these, any eligible thread gets the lock if multiple threads are eligible to get it. As I said, every library I am aware of uses the MESA-style approach. Every library you are likely to use in code you write today. And this is a reason why, you know, even if we didn't have spurious wake-ups, you still couldn't avoid that while loop in practical scenarios. So we have our implementation of producer-consumer, where consumers need to wait, but producers don't. We're going to add producers waiting. And this is going to show sort of what I like about monitors, which is that it's relatively easy to kind of add them piecemeal if you want more things to wait for. So we're going to say, oh, wait, I have a problem here that if we have the producers going really fast, we're going to fill up all our memory. So our fix for that problem is that we're going to let the buffer be full, and we're going to stop the producers while the buffer is full and have them not stop when the buffer isn't full. And we want to add that to this code, and we can kind of do that incrementally. So let's add that. And here's what I add. So I said, I have a new thing we need to wait for, so I'm going to make a new condition variable to represent the list of threads waiting for that thing. And what they're waiting for is they're waiting for space on the queue. So that's why I called it space ready. And I said, well, we're going to do that in produce, and basically we don't want to enqueue until we know the buffer is not full. So while the buffer is full, we're going to wait and we're going to add ourselves to the list of threads waiting for more space. And the other half of this, I need to say, well, when does the buffer not become go from full to not full? Well, that happens when we dequeue something. We add an extra slot to the buffer. So because of that, I'm going to signal that one produced thread can go every time we remove something from the buffer. And I can use signal safely because I know removing one thing gives us one slot in the buffer. So I don't need to broadcast. Only one thread can go. If I wasn't sure, I'd use broadcast. But I know in this case, only one thread can go for each time I dequeue. So that's going to work out. So you can see you can kind of write this code by implementing the version that doesn't wait for this thing and adding it later on. So questions about how this sort of space ready works? Yeah. Question, can I explain why signal is more risky than broadcast? So when we're doing signal, we are asserting that only one thread cares about what just happened. Only one thread can make useful progress. In this case, that's true. If we think about, say, the finished case, that was not true, right? If we had multiple threads waiting, they all should get to go. And if we aren't sure, we should broadcast, because what's going to happen is that we're going to do something that looks like a spurious wake-up, right? If we have a broadcast here, the worst that can happen is that the threads go back to their while loop, they figure out they can't actually do anything, and they start waiting again. So it might be slow, but at least it will be correct. Whereas if we use signal, it might not be correct. Does that answer your question? Question for broadcast, it tries to wake everyone up, but those who are not waking up will just be wasted execution time? Yes. And this is because we're following the rule of always having this while we need to wait. Because of that while loop, they'll always, any one of you wake up who's not supposed to be woken up, they'll just figure out that they weren't supposed to be woken up and start waiting again. Other questions, follow-ups? Yeah. Quick question, pthread client signal space ready is not saying we now have more space in the queue. Yes, and it's saying we know that threads on space ready are waiting for there to be space. So client signal is saying, if you are waiting for space, you can go now. Or you should go now and see if you can add something to the queue. And we learned that it might be the case that we wake up a thread and it can't actually do anything because someone else produces in between. But we know that if there's no one else around, that they should definitely be able to make progress. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So another thing about that's kind of like the broadcast versus signal thing. So I told you, you can broadcast extra times instead of signaling, and it's not wrong in the sense that your program will behave correctly. It's just going to be slow. Another thing we could do that's going to give us correct behavior but just be slow is that rather than having two separate lists of waiting threads, we could just have one list of waiting threads. And every time something changes, we could just wake them all up and have them figure out, can you keep going now? And that's, again, because we always have this while loop where when they wake up, they check, did I really want to be woken up? And if not, they start waiting again. And this, I think, is the reason why if you look at Java's implementation of monitors that are built into objects, they just have one condition variable. Well, it's enough, technically. Now, if you're writing code in Java that actually does this stuff, they have condition variable objects that are more flexible, which I would use instead. But sort of the Java version 1 monitors, they just have one condition variable because that's technically all you need. Questions? Other questions about our bounded buffer? So, to summarize, our general monitor pattern, we'll summarize this and we'll go through an exercise, is that we'll have code that we acquire a lock for some shared data, we check if something is true about that data that we need to wait for, and while that's not true, we keep waiting. We do something with the data, and then for everything other people could be waiting for, we check, did we change that? And if so, we broadcast to wake up everyone who was waiting for that to possibly change. And as an optimization, we can signal if we know only one thread will ever care. And if we aren't sure whether we change condition A, we can still broadcast and at least and have the thread figure it out if it's like too complicated for some reason for us to figure out whether we changed what they're waiting for. So this is kind of our general pattern. I have my kind of rules of thumb that we're going to have this shared data that we only access with a lock, and holding the lock, we're going to do this thing where we check the condition, then do something, check the condition, see if we need to wait, then do something. Importantly, we don't release the lock during that because we wanted to like see, is the buffer empty? Is the buffer not empty? Then dequeue. We don't want to check if the buffer's not empty, release the lock, then relock again, and then the buffer might be full, might be empty again. When we need to wait, we create a condition variable to store the list of threads waiting for something. And we have this loop checking that condition and calling wait on that condition variable. And we make sure whenever we change a condition, we broadcast or signal the corresponding condition variable to wake up the threads that were waiting. And we have these kind of shortcuts we could use to avoid thinking too hard about exactly what we need to do. So one is that if we are not sure if we change something, we can broadcast anyways, it's not going to break anything. If we aren't sure whether we should signal or broadcast, we can broadcast, at least it's going to be safe, it's not going to be fast. And if we can't figure out how to create like condition variables for every possible condition, we can use one condition variable for all of them and just have the while loops figure it out. Questions about sort of these rules for using monitors before we do little logistics and an example, some exercises. Okay, so I'll mention briefly that I didn't show how we create condition variables. It's very similar to mutexes in the pthreads API. Okay, so let's start with this case here. So here I have some code where I want to wait for two things to finish instead of one. So we have this wait for both finish function, which is going to wait for finish 0 and finished 1 to both be set to true. And that's going to happen because finish is going to be called with the index 0 or the index 1. So this is going to wait until finish 0 plus finish 1, both called. So that's our intended setup. So let's start with what goes in our, and I wrote that in the wrong place, what goes in our while loop here to make that up. Who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, E? Good, we all got this correct. And this is an exercise here, because if you do write code with conditioned variables, this is probably the most common mistake I see, is flipping the condition. So instead, using A instead of C. So in this case, we want to wait while either of them aren't finished, or while it's not the case that both are finished. Okay, how about, so here, for finish, we learned that B is a correct option in that it won't cause anything to break. But I want to know what's the best option. So B we know is correct because we can broadcast when nothing's changed and that's fine. And we can broadcast instead of signaling and that's fine. So we know B is not going to be cause incorrect behavior, but what's the best option? Question or?
C says signal.
C says signal. It does.
No, like on the second line it says single.
Oh, that, yes, it is. That is meant to be a correctly spelled name. Who'd like some more time? You people? Okay. Okay, so who thinks A is our best option? Thinks B is our best option. We can't do better than the thing that always works. Okay, C. Okay, D. Okay, E. No clue. Okay, so we have a mix of C, D, and no clue mostly. So the intuition for C and D collectively is we have this if statement which says basically if the other one is also finished. And if that's true, because we just set finished index to true, and finished 1 minus index is also true, that means the things that are waiting for both finished are ready to stop waiting. And if that's not true, they aren't ready to stop waiting. That if we wake them up, they're going to go to their while loop And as we just learned, they're going to find out, well, someone's not finished. I need to go wait again. So checking this if statement is going to be an optimization that wakes them up less often without breaking things. We're still going to wake them up every time they would actually be able to make progress. So doing this if statement is useful. As for the signal versus broadcast, well, we want to think about what if there are multiple threads waiting, because that's the only case where these are different. And for there to be multiple threads waiting, we have to have multiple threads call wait for both finished. So our question should be, what should happen if I have like 10 threads call wait for both finished? What should they do? And I think the only thing that makes sense is that they all should start running after both calls to finish have happened. And that means we should have a broadcast and not a signal. If we do a signal, only one of them is guaranteed to start running. So I would say D is our best option. Question, yes?
So that assumes that we're not writing the right code for the while loop, right? Because otherwise, things would have been like checked in the while loop.
So question, this assumes we're not writing the right code for the while loop. So our while loop needs to have the correct code regardless because of spurious wake-up. So we mentioned conwait could just randomly return. So we need to have the correct condition regardless. So this is best in the sense that it avoids waking up threads as often as we can while still waking them up when they need to be woken up. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So I have one more exercise to do. So let's implement a barrier, a one-use barrier. So we're not going to have it work multiple times. And since we don't have much time, I'm going to go basically over our solution for what goes in our missing code here. And if we think of what a barrier does, we have threads who need to wait for everyone to reach the barrier. So we'll have a condition variable to store the list of threads waiting on the barrier. I'll just call it, have a condition variable, and if not all threads have reached the barrier, so while more threads need to reach the barrier, more threads to reach barrier, thread cond wait on the CV. Lock, and we have this code that we have here, does actually the bookkeeping for us to turn that sort of pseudocode into real code because we have number reached and total threads. So while the number reached is not the total threads, wait. So then there's a question of what do we do when the number of reach does equal the total threads. That means everyone has reached the barrier. Well, we have a bunch of people who are waiting, and we just changed whether they need to keep waiting. So in this case, we will broadcast. And I should do this. And I have the written out version of this on a slide. So this is another example. So you can see we can implement barriers. And it turns out pretty much any synchronization construct you can think of by doing this sort of bookkeeping. So here I'm doing some bookkeeping. I'm tracking the number of threads that have reached a barrier to not because any of the threads actually care about that number, but to implement this kind of barrier abstraction. I can implement all sorts of coordination by just doing some bookkeeping, counting threads, counting things, and having conditions based on that. That's where we'll finish up today. So next time we will go on to probably not threads after maybe a little review.